Oh, well, you're not supposed to have that one. Just copy it off the sheet. Yeah, I don't have any more. I'm sorry. I didn't count those sheets and didn't realize other pages got mixed in them. If you've got the qualities of a successful team, just keep it. But I'm not going to lecture on that. The one example I wanted to pull out on the core values was this was designed primarily for a staff in a multiple staff situation. And the strategic planning team in our church right now is adapting the core values for the congregation as a whole. So we're having discussions about what is it that the congregation as a whole values. But the challenge in many churches is that we have a thing called silos. Now, do you know what a silo is? A silo is a department, an area of church life, which basically takes on its own identity and erects walls around it, and nobody else is supposed to touch it. The Women's Association in many churches is a silo, yeah. Or the Christian education ladies that work in the office on Sunday morning is a silo. And you know you have silos when there's territoriality, and you have extreme silos when they're in competition with each other. And silos are often in competition with each other for scarce resources. And the scarce resources are time, space, and money, and attention. Time, space, money, and attention. So if you watch in a church, you know, people will compete. And this can be lay people doing this. This can be a team, a staff team doing this, etc. So I walked into a church, and I discovered that I had a church made up of silos. And so you have this group over here, and this group over here, group over here. Silos are not interactive. Remember, I defined a team as interactive. Interactive means that we allow other people to permeate, and we are permeable, meaning what we do is available to inspection. What we do is available to input from other people. So that one of the words to break down silos is you need transparency and you need a free exchange of information. If I don't know anything about what you're doing in your area, I can't support you. No. And so if you do your thing and all we do is battle over who gets which room, we have one wonderful room in our church that everybody wants to meet in. And it is fascinating to see the way in which people will go to work battling over scarce resources. Now, and I inherited the thing where the person ahead of me hated committee meetings, and so he scheduled them all on the same night, and all programs on the same night, and the youth programs, and the choir programs, and the committees were all on the same night, and that way he only had to be out one night a week. Of course, it made the competition for scarce resources incredible, because we didn't have enough space to do that. Yeah. And so people were in closets, and people were unhappy, and there was a very simple answer, you know, which was come back and say, what are we trying to accomplish here? Yeah, you know, it turned out what we were trying to accomplish was to keep the pastor from having to go to too many meetings. That's not a good vision. Yeah. You know? I believe in it, but it's not a good vision for a church. Yeah, you know? And so we had to go through and say, well, does, you know, one pastor have to be at all those meetings? You know, and there are a whole bunch of issues that came up with that kind of thing. I wanted to just briefly touch these because I do think these are good values for teams. That we are Christians, and that's first and foremost and primary, and that's why it's there. And that means we want to live like Christians, act like Christians, and be Christians to one another. So everything the Bible says about being a Christian applies to us. Love one another. You know, if you've got aught against your brother, forgive one another. You know, go keep short accounts. If somebody's got aught against you, you go and clean it up. You know, being a Christian means all of the ethical admonitions, all of the principles of communication, speaking the truth in love, all that the Bible teaches about how Christians are to live together applies to us. We don't have a separate thing because we get paid. Yeah. Everything it says about being a Christian. We don't have a separate thing because we're the preschool department. We have a preschool in our church, and it used to be us and them. Anytime you hear us and them language, you're not Christian. Because us and them isn't Christian. That's not the unity of the body of Christ. No. Anytime you have us and them, which basically says you need us, you don't need them, it's saying, you know, I'm a hand, I don't need a toe. Yeah. And it's a violation, biblically. So, we're Christians. Really matters. And it's not just we believe in Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. We are committed to the Lordship of Christ in all of our life, and we live by the power of the Holy Spirit, dependent on God, to be for and with each other. Okay, we are servants. Really important. The world's model, Jesus said, Gentiles, lord it over, not to be so among you. And then why is it we reproduce that model in every church structure I ever heard of? We busily reproduce hierarchy. And it's one of the things that Jesus absolutely clearly said, no, not to be that way among you. It's one of the problems with men and women. It's one of the problems in all white and black. It's one of the problems in American and Chinese. I mean, we're all the time wanting to know who's on top. Now, who's number one? Yeah, that is not Christian. Yeah. The one who wants to lead should be a servant. That's real. That's practical. That's hard. That takes God's love and God's grace flooding into your life. But not to be so. So we are servants. What does that mean here? It means that even if I'm the pastor of this church, nobody is here to serve me. I'm here to serve them. I'm the chairman of the finance committee. This church does not exist to serve me. I exist to serve them. I'm the president of the Women's Association. This church does not exist to serve me. I exist to serve them. We are responsive and responsible. The average church is so non-responsive to people's needs that it's incredible. Yeah. I could tell you stories, but I won't. It's not my job. It's not my responsibility. Why doesn't somebody do something? And I had a woman stop me on the patio last Wednesday night, just a little short story, and she was a half an hour early for a meeting and didn't know where the meeting was. Or it was a class, actually, and she couldn't even remember the title of the class. And we started to visit. She said, I want you to know that I came to your church for the first time in 5 years. As I'd come to your church 5 years ago, and she said, when I came to your church 5 years ago, I walked into that church, and I don't know how the church did this, and maybe it was something in me that was going on, but I just felt like this church was smug and arrogant, and I don't know how they did it, but I felt like a nothing in that church. Nobody greeted me. I didn't feel like I was dressed right. It was awful. And so, even though I live in the neighborhood and I wanted to come to this church, I have not come back to this church for 5 years. She said, last Sunday I came to church. She said, I couldn't believe. She said, I couldn't even get onto the patio before people were greeting me, before people were asking me, questions and listening, to me. And the ushers were so friendly. You know, we had ushers who acted as if they were doing people a favor to hand them a bulletin, much less helping them find a seat. But she said, and then we greeted each other in the worship experience. I start each service with the welcome time instead of doing announcements in the middle. And she said the entire experience was totally different. She said it feels so good to be home. Yeah. What did it take? Responsive. She needed a church to be responsive. Remember last night, those of you who heard my talk about Rich? The reason Rich became a Christian, had his life turned around, is the receptionist didn't look at a homeless man and say, there's a shelter somewhere down the road, go find it, but was responsive to his needs. And then a pastor was responsive. And then a schizophrenic man was responsive. And people were responsive. But responsive, we are also responsible. So we're responsible for results. And this is important value to lay out. that we're responsive, which means we're interruptible, but we are also responsible to get our jobs done. So if you're the children's person, you are to be responsive to people, even if they're not children or teachers of children. You don't say, it's not my job, it's not my area, it's not my territory, it's not my department. You know? But you don't be so amorphous and all over the map that you just wander around and don't get your work done. So everybody's responsible. And it's important in teams that people know what they're responsible for. Yeah. So what are you responsible to accomplish? Not just showing up, but what are you responsible to accomplish? So you have a team. Let's say you're going to have your potluck. What are you responsible for? I am responsible to talk to two people that I do not ordinarily talk to and make those two people feel welcome at this potluck. You have to be responsible to save 9,000 people. But everybody should be responsible for some result. Not just, I'm going to go talk to two people. I am going to help two people feel welcome and warm about being here. That's different than just, I'm going to talk to two people. See, that's an activity. The result is, what are they going to feel? What are they going to know, feel, or do as a result of our interaction? So responsible. What result are you willing to be responsible for? And you cannot lay responsibilities on people. They have to pick them up. You can't scold them into it. They have to pick them up. And that means you have to model it. You have to be responsive yourself, and you have to be responsible yourself. Yeah. Then we are learners. Very important to me. We are constantly studying. And in our situation, we are giving our team resources all the time. Our session retreat, everyone read a book by Ken Blanchard and Bill Hybels. For that retreat, they came prepared with sections marked, and we spent a full hour then using what they had prepared. We took the theme of the heart of a servant leader, you know, from the book, and the whole group. So now they have that in common. They have a vocabulary in common, the principles to be worked out. And then we said, okay, in your team, how would it work out? Is you're working at this a contract on 12 ways to develop a servant heart. What would that mean for you and your teams and those kinds of conversations? But we're constantly providing resources. And people need input. They need input. Something I believe, even in the smallest church, is we undershoot and underestimate what people are capable of. I really believe that. People were made by God to keep learning. And the scripture talks about being transformed by the renewal of your mind. And have you given your people anything to chew on? Whether that's Xeroxing off one page, one thing we do in program staff. We have a pastor staff, program staff, and a support staff. And in program staff, which is the directors of ministries, is we very often, those of you who've got that one sheet, on qualities of a servant leader. What's the title on that, really?
Qualities of a winning team.
The discussion leader for that day Xeroxed off that piece of paper, which came out of the Leadership Network. Craig Ogden, who was a student of mine, developed that particular piece. And everybody was given that sheet and given time to read it during the meeting. So they got 10 minutes to read it. And then we had a discussion about each of the items. I think there are 7 things on that particular one. And so a different person was asked to discuss each thing, and we talked about it. So we all worked it through together. Well, we're learners. And so it took us 20 minutes, but we all got kind of a model of what a winning team looks like, that everybody participated in the conversation and the discussion. They learned something in spite of themselves. I have people that will go to sleep in a meeting just like that if you give them a chance. Their eyes are open. Yeah, and so it isn't simply that you tell them to go and do something. You provide time for training in what you're doing. So you have a committee that you want it to be a team. You do training in the committee meeting. Now,
You don't just have something extra, you build it in. So we are learning. We are constantly learning. So if you go somewhere, we want to learn from you when you come back. And so we'll ask, what did you learn? You know, that we could learn from. And so we teach each other. And it's not one way. It's mutual. It's interactive. But you can take a book and assign a different chapter to each person on your team and ask them to teach that chapter to the other people on the team. Yeah, and that means they'll read it. And so it isn't one person doing this. This can be everybody. But we're learners. It's a value. Is it a value in your situation? In some situations, it's not a value. Yeah. But winning teams are teams that keep learning. We seek excellence. And in the written one, on each of these, we wrote what we meant more. We unpacked the language. If you didn't get a copy, you might just look at someone else's copy to see that we put scripture verses underneath these, and we tried to fill out the language a little bit to say, what do we mean, you know, by this? And because we follow God who created all things beautiful and good, we seek to use our gifts and abilities in ways which reflect His greatness and glory. Why do we seek excellence? Because we serve an excellent God. And that means, are our bathrooms dirty? Yeah. That reflects on the glory of God. Yeah. Are our nurseries scummy? That reflects on what our God is like. Are we content to hand out things that look like they were invented in 1940? Yeah. And we didn't care enough to try within our budget to make it the best that it could be. Sometimes it's nothing more than planting 5 petunias, you know, in the right place in front of the building that reflects the glory of God. But we seek excellence. Now, that has a lot of implications, you know, but it matters because we didn't in our church. people rise to the levels that they discuss and get a vision of. They want their lives to count, to have significance, and to mean something. So the issue here is I'm not in competition with anybody. I'm seeking excellence to reflect the greatness of God. We're not doing it to beat out so-and-so and so-and-so. You know? I remember once when I was church staff, I had to make the posters. I have absolutely no artistic ability. None. Zip. And I used to go look at greeting cards just to get ideas because I couldn't even get any ideas for anything. And then I'd have to make these posters myself. And once, standing in the hall listening, an elder walked past the signboard outside my office and said, oh, I see Roberta's been making posters again. And I walked out and I said, how do you know that I made that poster? He said, well, the lines are crooked. You know, the type runs downhill, etc. It has your sure touch on it. And I thought, yeah, this is not the message that I am trying to send. You know, and so I found a graphic designer, layperson, in our church, and said, you have got to do the posters. Yeah. And the person felt called, you know, because they realized I didn't have the gift to do that. We needed excellence. She did have the gift to do that, and she was willing to do it for that reason, because she wanted excellence. And we are stewards. Nothing we have belongs to us. This isn't my church. This isn't your committee. This isn't your flock. Everything we have, people, money, resources, buildings, materials, a mimeograph machine, a Xerox machine, everything we have does not belong to us. That is revolutionary in the way people work together. Depending on the size of your church, I have a camera, says the high school director. Mine. You can't use it. I have a preschool closet. We put a padlock on it. We wouldn't want the children of Sunday school to use the stuff in there. We have a kitchen. I've seen whole churches
come unglued over letting somebody use the kitchen. It's my kitchen. No, it's not. It's God's kitchen. God's kitchen. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk to each other about responsible use, but it's God's kitchen. So, we're stewards. That's very important, darling. And then the last one, we care deeply for each other as we care for the church, is the one where we had to face that we didn't. We had to be honest. And so we set about this as a value. This is something we're going to try and do more and more. We're going to spend time working at this because we need it. It's hard, but it matters. And so the language, we desire to work together as a truly Christian community of persons who love and care for each other beyond the superficial. Those words were important. This includes respecting and affirming each other in our diverse gifts and ministries, as well as seeking ways to strengthen our personal relationship with each other and our families. We hope to grow in love as one sign of the kingdom of God in the midst of the church in the world. So it's very clearly an area where we know, you know, we have to work at it. But by God's grace, we're making progress. Yeah. The whole idea is not that we are perfectly any of these things, but these are things we value. So this conversation really can help build a team, and it's worth taking the time. If you got one value in 3 months, it's worth taking the time. Yeah. And I actually started with values before I did vision and mission. I just felt we were too task-oriented, and it was too easy to get right at what we want to accomplish, and I wanted to find out what mattered to us. And this was the result. Comments? Questions? Huh? Here's one more, too, because I can. Can you get them made? That's great. Thanks. Okay. The question of how do you seek excellence or encourage excellence without perfectionist practice and is a real issue for me. Because people have different gifts and see things differently and define excellence in different kinds of ways. So some of what you have to do is parse what do you mean, you know, when you say excellence, because the word itself does not, what I've discovered is there are people, I'll give an example from a college. I'd walk around with the head of maintenance at our college. And he would see one thing, and I would see something completely different. And neither one of us was being ornery. We just saw different things. And he would see, you know, the structural stuff, and I would see whether the paint was fresh. And so learning how each other saw things was an important part of not being, with perfectionism, is the definition. A perfectionist tends to have a critical spirit. Self-critical and critical of others for not measuring up to some standard, you know, that's inside. Seeking excellence, is desiring the best without a critical spirit. But rooting, you know, and helping, energizing each other to be the best we can be. And that means you're always working within limitations. People have so many hours in the day, so much energy. You know, the realities are there. But within that reality, we seek the best. You have to talk about it. And you have to deal with the perfectionist side. At least I have had to deal with that with myself. And the expectation of a perfectionist is that everybody is judging off the same standard. And so the fact that I see it and he doesn't see it means he failed. You know, and so you can give people a message of failure, which is very unhelpful. I think you encourage people to excellence. You don't penalize them toward excellence. You don't scold towards excellence. You encourage. And what that means is affirming every step in the right direction. You don't wait to affirm until the final goal is achieved. You affirm every step people make along the way to the goal that you have. I had a maintenance guy when I came to this church, and we had 5 spots on the front door of the church where the paint had worn off. And I asked if we could have that painted, and he said, "I don't do painting. I'm a supervisor." And I said, "Give me the brush." But his definition was, he wasn't seeking excellence. He was seeking the pride that came in a role definition. And the role does not matter as much as the result. Yes. How do you go about starting a kingdom? First, you pray. I have sometimes prayed for as long as 6 months, asking God to show who the right people are to build this team with. You look for gifts and heart. You think about what this team is to accomplish if God were to bless. And when you're brand new, you work with what you've got, you know, basically. But if you have freedom to choose, you're looking for heart, passion, giftedness in whatever area it is you want the team to work on. What results do you want out of the team? Then you're looking for people, ideally, who are gifted and have passion, have a heart for those results. And many times, the people that you need aren't yet in your church. And you have to pray them into your church. I have been amazed to see the way God will bring people into a church. If you are patient and seriously prayerful, sometimes the leadership you want needs to be converted first. And that's one reason why you need to be about calling people to Christ and serious and growing. You look and say, "We got a leadership crisis. There's no leadership here." Maybe the leader God wants to give you is still to come to your church. And I don't think our challenge is just reshuffle the leadership we have. So the model of Jesus, basically, where he met, the disciples said to Jesus, "Where are you staying?" And Jesus said, "Come and see." And so he invited the first disciple to be involved in his life. And he shared life with them. And then he shared ministry with them. And then it says he prayed all night in Luke. He prayed all night before he chose the 12. And so prayer is not a cliche. It's very serious. And I think Jesus was looking for certain qualities. And it's interesting to me that when Jesus looked at people, he saw what was in them. And so he names James and John the sons of thunder. Yeah. Meaning he looked at who they were and what were their passions and how did they function, you know. So we can't put a team together without taking the time to get to know people, somewhat. Temporary teams, you can take more risks. Teams that are going to be semi-permanent, you want to take time. Which in our process means for formal leadership, we have a nominating committee, and it's very important to spend significant time training that committee to know how to identify leaders and gifts and prayerfully recruit and all those kinds of things. In my little book on committees to community, there is a little section in there on recruiting, and I don't have time really to repeat all of that, but after you prayerfully discern some possible people, you go to recruit, and you recruit them to what you want to actually have happen. You don't say, it won't take much time, and nobody else is available to do it. You say, I have a serious job for you that I'd like you to pray about, and you've thought through the job description. And what is it you're really hoping for from this person? If you just only expect them to show up for 2 hours, tell them you want them to sit on a committee.
I remember we had a committee on the committee.
Yes. They wanted, yeah, which is very different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But one of the issues in recruiting is that you have a conversation, for instance, that no one sits on this committee who does not do some of the servant's work of this committee. You're not being asked to join a group that votes and decides. You're being asked to join a group that does the work. That's the difference when you recruit. And so there is no one sitting here who isn't being a servant in some specific, concrete area of ministry. So you want to sit on the Christian Ed Committee? What area of Christian education are you going to be working in? And so that you have the servant piece of it, and not just the deciding piece. Authority and responsibility need to go together. And when you separate them, you get very bad, you know, situations. But if you really just want them on there to rubber stamp what you're going to do, you need to be honest about that. Because it's not fair to them to say, I remember once I formed a leadership council. They do these in colleges. What they are devices to raise money from high-level people. So you ask them to be on the leadership. And this one was called the Leadership Advisory Board. And the CEO of the largest bank in Philadelphia said, I'm willing to be on your leadership advisory board if you'd tell me what advice you want and what advice you're going to take. And I went back. I was new at the time, and it was very clear that this board was to give money. It wasn't to give advice. They had labeled it that way, you know, in order to get the money. And I went back to him, and I said, it's really about financial support, you know, and it's not about advice. You know, I'm not going to ask you how to run the college. And he came on board anyway. He became the chair. But he needed honesty. So I think you have to, you know, be honest with that. So you've got to recruit. I think you always recruit giving people an opportunity to say no so that you don't twist people's arms. They make a free choice. And you give them time to think and pray about it. And you make time-limited commitments. I'm asking you to serve for 2 years. First year is a learning curve, second year you're effective, and you have to find your own replacement by the end of the 2 years. And you say that up front. You don't change the covenant or the contract midway. You recruit them to come sit in a committee, and then you up the ante every month until they're supposed to be at church 88 hours out of the week. You know, it's not fair. You have to pray that through and think that through and recruit realistically and give people freedom to say no. And when you give them that freedom, you say to them, if not now, possibly next year. And many, many times I have found in recruiting that I was recruiting for next year. And instead of just kind of dismissing and being disappointed, you know, that the person didn't come through that you wanted to come through, if you realize that you, if you care about them, you're seeding a relationship that a year from now may emerge in this person stepping into leadership. You don't lose in those conversations. People appreciate being respected and given freedom to make honest decisions instead of having their arms twisted. The guys that work around me, the women don't say this, but some of the guys who are business types will talk about how I've twisted their arm. They love to joke with each other about that. And at no time have I ever twisted their arms. But I do tell them how serious it is and how costly it is and what it's going to take. And I find people respond to that. And they're tired of wimpy church. They want to change the world and make a difference or contribute. And I don't want the ones that don't want to do that. You know, it depends on the level and what it is. I have a woman who does our potlucks. And she has a gift for potlucks. She's just great at organizing potlucks. That's what we want her to do. She didn't have to run the church. She could run the potlucks. And we're happy to let her use her gift that way. It's a gift of hospitality. And it's tremendous to affirm, you know, that gift in her. So that's pieces of putting that team together. Okay? That can be interpreted in several different ways. So let me be generous. It is true that you do not want to recruit to a significant team people who do not share your heart and vision. People may have different temperaments and may come at things differently than you do, that you value. Good teams are diverse teams. They're not clones, you know, of the leader. They're not rubber stamps. You want those gifts. You want that energy and all that. But if you deliberately recruit people who do not share your vision or your fundamental value set, for instance, if you want to pray in your meeting and you deliberately recruit somebody who believes you should only pray in your closet and it is sinful to pray in a meeting, you're going to be at loggerheads every time you have a meeting. Because this person, you know, has one concept and you have another concept. That's why recruiting, as part of what you're doing into recruiting is trying to find out, are we on the same spiritual page? That does not mean that we would do the task in the same way, that our gifts are identical, or this person's going to rubber stamp. But you do want, and your pastor is right in saying you want people so that you're not building a team so you can fight with them. You're building a team because you want to accomplish something. And if you deliberately put, let's say I had one team I inherited where a guy identified himself as devil's advocate. And so it didn't matter what we did. He was always going to say no. He's always going to be on the other side. That's the role he chose to take in that setting. And as soon as I had a decent opportunity to move him off the team, I did. Because he was wasting our time. And on the other side, just say that I believe it is a mistake to only put people on a team who go passive and reactive. This isn't a team. This is something else. And who are always going to vote the way you are. There's a principle I believe in very much, which is accountability. That every one of us needs to be accountable. And so when a pastor chooses a leadership team that the pastor cows or dominates and will not be accountable to, will not be mutually involved with, even though the leader has a leadership function, if the pastor is not willing to be accountable and instead is manipulative, you're not going to have the kind of strong, healthy spiritual team that you want to have. But Jesus didn't deliberately go out and choose 12 who didn't agree with his mission. He didn't put the Pharisees and the Sadducees in the inner band as a way to win them. What you want is to pull a team together of one heart and mind that care about what it is you're trying to accomplish. So it's wisdom that needs to be exercised there. I've always been stretched by people who disagree with me, but I am not helped by people who attack and who come with kind of an agenda that is distrustful, or they're working their own angle. I don't happen to be a charismatic. I am charismatic, biblically, but I don't speak in tongues. And I've often had people who just had that experience want to get on the leadership team because their goal was to change the whole church to become X kind of church. That's not helpful. You know, we're not sharing the same basic values in terms of what it is we're trying to do here. I don't forbid that behavior, but I'm not going to put someone whose agenda is not our agenda, but their own individual agenda for the church on the governing board so that we have to fight about that issue every time we have a meeting. Yeah. So. Hand. Okay. Right. All right. Let's move on from here, and I'm going to make a decision, because I do want to talk about one of the things a little bit. I'm going to tell you five things that every winning team has to have, has to know, and then I'm going to give you one model for leadership, and I think I'll leave it at that. Here's five things that every team has to have, and this can arise from within the team. This can be a conversation directed by the team leader. This can be done from below, beside, and above, to use human kinds of terms. You can help this to happen even if you are not in charge, is what I'm trying to say here. If you are in charge, you can facilitate this out of positional authority, not just personal authority. But five things that have to happen is that you have to help people deal with expectations. People on winning teams have to know what is expected from each one. The second is opportunity. Every member of a team has to have an opportunity to perform or to contribute. Every member. No team can have silent members. That means when you have a meeting, you have to give people an opportunity to share what they've done. You have to reinforce. You know, they have to have airtime and airspace. I was the chair of a significant committee of 14 people come in and run the meeting, so he talked all the time, and gradually the committee dropped away till there were three people left on the committee. They weren't interested in coming to a meeting where they weren't allowed to contribute anything. And that's the problem with domineering pastors or domineering chairs or whatever. Everybody needs to be able to contribute, which means you have to design tools, sharing questions, interactions, polling, where you go around, you know, and let each one talk, something that we work on together even though we each have different areas of responsibility. Everyone has to have an opportunity to perform. If they do not, they will be present but passive. They won't own the goal. They won't take responsibility. They won't be energized. You won't have a wow team. Third, you have to care about how each one is getting along. There must be care and interest expressed in the other team members, which means that you tune into them as persons, not just as roles. Pam is the director of our preschool. If we never ask Pam a question about Pam, and we only ask Pam about the preschool, we're not expressing care and interest in Pam. However, Pam loves the preschool. If we never ask a question about the preschool, we're not expressing care and interest in Pam either. You have to care about the things that they care about. Yeah, and so a good team has this interaction of people expressing interest and care in the other's person as well as the role that they are taking on, you know, for you. So that expression has to happen. And then the fourth is guidance. That guidance will be given when and where it is needed. That you don't take people on teams and just throw them into the water and say, swim. You know, we do this all the time. You know, you teach the fourth grade class, swim. You know, and they don't know how to swim with fourth graders. You know, and we have to coach, guide, give help. That doesn't mean we personally have to know everything. But we need to know where the resources are. You know, and we need to help each other find resources, access resources, etc., so that there will be guidance. This can be mentoring. This can be partnering. I try never to put people on a task alone, but always to put partners on a task. So we were doing a new tape ministry years ago, and I had an engineer willing to do the tape ministry, and I made sure he had a partner so that there would be care. You know, there would be relationships. So you don't just send people out in solitude to get this job done, unless they're a virtual committee and they're doing it, communicating over the net or whatever. Guidance. Fifth one is that there will be rewards. Every team member needs rewards. You as pastors need rewards. You are a member of the team. What rewards do you need? Mainly, you need recognition and affirmation. Recognition and affirmation. There are some saints, in the limited definition of that word, who don't need recognition and affirmation, but I think even Mother Teresa appreciated recognition and affirmation. Otherwise, I don't know why she would have gone around the world getting so much of it. Everybody needs their spot in sunlight. Now, and it is not, you need to do it in two ways. You've got to do it one-on-one. People need it personally. It's not enough to do it public. You need to do it face-to-face. But you also need to do it publicly. And people care about whether their names get written in the bulletin. And people care about whether or not they work like dogs. Anybody knows that they work like a dog. And they always say, oh, no, no, no. But if you didn't do it. Yeah. And so I think about rewards, too. I give books, because I'm a book person. But small presents mean something to people. You ask yourself the question, what would make this person feel, August, and I'll say I'm going to use this to reward, you know, the staff or a team or, you know, whatever. So the physical rewards, I used to do a thing called popcorn awards, where the, this was in the college and we had more people to draw from, but it was the, not for just doing your job, it was for the most, unusual, outstanding, went the extra mile, did the unexpected, really helped somebody reward. And people got to nominate each other for the popcorn award. And what they got with the award was they gave them a jar of popcorn and a gift certificate to McDonald's. And people died for that award. They were so happy to get it. And you realize it's impossible to over-affirm. That's it. You don't want to get into a situation where you're doing fancy, expensive, show-off kinds of things, where you get a competitive spirit going. That's not what you're after. It's not winning the trophy that you're after. It's affirmation and a sense of, aren't we happy that, you know, this went on. And that means a little creativity. Let me put it to you this strongly. If you're not prepared to reward people, don't ask them to serve. Think that out. Pray that out. Sometimes the reward is your company. And you have to think about the fact that if you're going to build a team, you're going to have to be available. And that's costly. This depends on how your life goes, but that can be the most costly reward at all. Yeah. And so you're going to think about what do they need so that they will feel valued. Not what I need. For me to feel valued, you know, which would be a nice big pay raise, you know, but what do they need in order to feel valued? Yeah, you know, you bet. I suggest taking every team on a one-day retreat. Yeah, and you have, if you can't, the best idea is definitely to be in a home or off the campus with nature, where there is space for a walk or to sit out in the sunlight. Definitely out of the building. Buildings are artificial. First three centuries of the church didn't have buildings. You know, get your people in homes, in informal environments, you know, as much as you can. You don't have to spend a lot of money to have a retreat. You just go to somebody's home. But don't have the leader be the person who provides the home. You know, so share the responsibilities and stuff for that. I'm looking at my watch and the I've got tons more I could do, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to put one chart up and just tell you where you can find it so that you could read the book that goes with it, okay? And this is a model of leadership behavior for team leaders. And that's a committee chair or the pastor or whatever. and it's called the Situational Leadership Model, and I'm not going to take the time to teach you the whole model. I'm going to give you the basic principle. The kind of leadership that is needed in a given situation varies. No one model of leadership is appropriate to every context. And it varies depending on a couple of things. Whether you have a new team that you are developing or you have a developed team. And that depends on whether or not you have competence and commitment. The more competence and commitment you have, the more delegation you can do. The less competence and commitment you have, the more directive you have to be in your behavior. So the four modes of team leadership are directing, coaching, supporting, and delegating. And immature new teams or quasi-permanent teams that have new members in them need more on the directive coaching side. And very experienced teams, I do not direct the seven pastors I work with. Yeah. I don't tell them what to do. Yeah. We're much more in a supporting, and I'm in a coaching mode with the younger ones, particularly in that particular thing. Now, just notice the two dimensions of all groups, and this includes teams very particularly here. And the two dimensions on the bottom line, it is a task orientation, and going up the side, it is a relationship orientation. Task, relationship. And the behavior you're engaged in is either directive or supportive. This gets at some of the stuff we were talking about. And when you're in a low competence kind of situation, you may need to be highly directive, highly task oriented, relatively low support, perhaps at that stage. Yeah. But you have to have both task and the directive side of that then. So you know it's a task dimension, and your question is, how directive do I need to be? And on the other side, it's a relationship dimension, and the question is, how relational do I need to be? How much time and energy do I need to put into supportive behavior? And when you get out of balance, sometimes I find that I get very tasky, and I have to deliberately come back and up the relational side of it and engage in supportive behavior. More affirmation. More encouragement. You know, more fun. Supportive behavior. Other times, you know, we're just having a great time, but we need to get more tasks done. And we need to be more successful in achieving the results that we're after. But in every team, you've got both dimensions. And one of the issues about what do you need to do when is how developed is your team, how balanced and healthy is your team. And you can be highly one thing or another for a time, but over time, you have to balance it out. You have to have both supportive and directive or task-oriented kinds of behaviors. So this is found in the book that I mentioned to you earlier, Three Keys to Empowerment, and Ken Blanchard, John Carlos, C-A-R-L-O-S, and Alan Randolph. The publisher of this series, yes. Yes. That chart comes out of there. This book will help you more with it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is 1999. That is back 5-6 years ago. And this is much more, how do you actually get there with your team? So he's been using the same diagram for 20 years.
Okay.
But each time it gets a little clearer about how you do it. This is a publisher that is not a familiar one. Barrett Keeler. So B-E-R-R-E-T-T dash K K-O-E-H-L-E-R. Barrett Keeler, San Francisco. And I'll pass this around so that you can take a look at it. And it's very practical and very helpful to actually how do you move your teams from developing to developed. And it's quite concrete. And the magic word in this book is empowerment. How do you empower people? And I would use, moving over to Christian language, I would talk about lay ministry. How do you equip for people and encourage them for lay ministry? And this is some of the best stuff I've seen that actually helps you to do that. People talk the rhetoric and don't know how to do it. And this does empower people. Some of these methodologies are very helpful. Okay, I'm going to change the subject. Okay? So, and we're going to talk a little bit about male-female. And I'm going to do it in response to any questions, issues that any of you, male or female, want to put on the table in terms of working together, men and women, and issues for women in ministry, particularly. So, your time. When you signed up for this, those of you who signed up for it, you had something on your mind. Yes. Okay. Yeah, lots of opinions. But because of time, I'm just going to leap right in. You won't get there from here in the way you're coming at it. Okay. If I could listen better, I wouldn't say it that flatly. But you're announcing a rule-driven behavior. You have a woman on the staff, you ought to have women on the board. Rule-driven behavior never gets you the result that you want. That's why the kind of affirmative action policies ran into so much resistance and trouble, although I believe in affirmative action. I just need to tell you that. But if you want the result that you want, you have to do value clarification. And so the job of value clarification is we have to talk about, do we value and want women on the board? That's the question. You don't come with the answer. You come with a question. You don't hide that you care about that. But if your pastor says, I care about women, you know, I'd like to have women on the board, then the issue is, how can we empower women so that they can serve on the board? That's a different question. See? Because then you go to work on the issues of empowerment. What empowers, what disempowers? You know, and how does that happen? And what you probably really have is that you have a lack of genuine commitment to believing that it's worthwhile or important either to the women or to the men to have women in leadership. And you've got a traditional hierarchical male over female understanding that nobody's willing to own up to. And but if you tackle them head on at the power issue level, you might win, but you won't really. You have to tackle them at the can we unpack the why do we believe in women, why would we want any women, do we really believe all women are incompetent, have nothing to give in this situation, and it takes a relative patience but intentional process. But your goal ought to be clear in your own head. What's your goal? If your goal is to force a woman onto the board and she fails, you will have reinforced every prejudice that anybody ever had. So your goal is that over time, assuming you'll be there any length of time at all, you want to help one or more women succeed in new roles in that. And so you ask yourself, what do I have to do to help women succeed? Simply getting them on the board does not make them succeed. And so you have to figure out, you know, how can I empower women? How can I model such competence that 2 years from now it's going to be ridiculous that there are no women on the board because I did my job and made my contribution that the pastor is saying, I wish I had 5 more like her. Yeah. So it's how you come at it. It's a large part of it. Then how are you empowering women? And maybe you want to start a small group in which you are doing leadership development and you're taking tasks and helping women to step up to challenges. Many women have been told they should not be leaders. They've been indoctrinated into believing they can't do it. And, you know, you will have to work with them so that if they got invited to serve, they would answer yes. But that can take you a year or two, you know, to pull that off until the place comes 5 years from now when that's just not an issue anymore. You know, and it can come. I've seen it come over and over and over again. But I've seen the power way of trying to make it come fail over and over again, too. And just break your heart over that. Yeah. So this is called the creative Christian subversion, where, you know, if Jesus had gone to the Sanhedrin and said, you know, I want my people on the Sanhedrin, yeah, wouldn't have worked that way. Jesus pulled a group of people around him. You know, maybe the small group that you pull around you is men and women. But you are empowering, you're giving women tasks and opportunities in that group, just as you are giving men opportunities and tasks, and women are discovering, hey, I can do this. I have something to give here. And they get a new insight into themselves. So it may not be just a women's group. It may be a common task that has men and women that you have carefully prayed about and placed on that leadership team to accomplish something that once they see the results, you know, people will say, you know, we could use more of that. So I think you're in the wind of God, and you work towards a goal like that, and you won't see it fully accomplished, but you can make a difference in helping move, you know, that environment and those assumptions. Then eventually you have to do some of the biblical work and identify where some of the resistance is coming from. So people do have to work through the biblical passages, etc. But you have to pick your time and place, you know, to help them know theologically. But it's usually, in your case, it's psychological resistance. We've just not seen women doing it. We don't have the experience of it. It feels strange. If it feels strange, it must not be right. And you just have to do it well enough so it feels comfortable, you know, as time goes along. And so they get used to it. They do change. Other comments or questions? The carving out your own role thing that you're dealing with is very difficult and yet doable as well. And I've seen it be very hard. I've worked with lots and lots of clergy couples at Fuller, and have watched the career patterns, you know, over the years, and it's not an easy road to hoe. And the one thing I've discovered on that is that usually means you need to be in a larger town rather than a smaller one, just as a starter. That if there are not more opportunities in the area, you know, the typical small town, you know, church just isn't going to be the right environment for two people who want to both exercise ministry. Is going to in a formal way. There's going to have to be. You're going to have to target bigger locations as just a starter for where you're going to go. My husband and I, working out the two career patterns, discovered years ago, he's a scientist, that we could go anywhere where there was a major research university. And he was willing to move because it was harder for me to get the call. And so he's been flexible and willing to go. But it's meant we've had to go to towns with major research universities. That there were things that I just simply have not done because there was no opportunity for him, you know, in that environment. And I turned down one college presidency simply because he job hunted. There was not a major research university there, and there was nothing really that he could do with his gifts. And so you have to kind of negotiate that. And sometimes you're taking turns, where one is more satisfied than the other one is. But at least one little thing on it is you just have to go to a metropolitan area that's got multiple opportunities in it, or you're just dead before you start. It's very, very difficult in a truly small town. Okay.
Talk to you as a man.
There's some dynamics. If you and they know you are temporary, that affects what goes on. regardless. I mean, so that's a kind of a count against. Because the challenge to change, either on your part or their part, is not so much there. You know your temper. One of the things that I found very helpful was that for a man who has the opportunity or access to the power structure, which you have on a multiple staff situation, to use that access and power to empower those who do not have that access and power. And I'll give you a small example. In a little church I was in with a solo pastor, he got asked if he would lead the Bible study for women. And he said, no, I won't, but I'll go talk to Roberta. And this is how I got started doing small group work in a church. That man used his power to empower me, because the group hadn't thought of asking me. I was a young mother, I was pregnant, I had two babies, you know, and he just said, there's no reason I should be doing that, she should be doing that. And recently I met some women that were out of that group. That group was 30 years ago, and that was just a joy, you know, to get to meet these women. But so in every situation where you can, you want to give gifted women access, visibility, public affirmation, etc. A second piece is that very often women in all female groups have patterns that when you're in mixed gender groups are different. That's sometimes why women get frustrated when they're working in teams with males and vice versa, because you really have to develop a different style. And usually for the male it means being intentionally more relational, and for the females it means being intentionally more task. And that is not true of persons, but it is a generalization that seems to hold, that women will more easily self-disclose than most men will, and that the sexes feel safer self-disclosing with their own gender than they do cross-gender. So usually means for the men you've got to work harder to create an environment of appropriate self-disclosure. And the women, you women usually have to work harder to make it clear that they understand how to do tasks and that they're results oriented. I suppose the other thing I would say, since I tend to come off a task model, is that when I hit a largely female support staff, where I am now, I have no idea how typical this is, except that I'm in two covenant groups with pastors who tell me that it's pretty typical. I found a high degree of gossip as a normal social interaction, including negative gossip. I guess I mean the word gossip as negative. And cliques formed and all this kind of stuff. And I had to do very intentional teaching. That's part of where I started on the values, etc. And one of the teachings I've had to do is on triangling. And you all know the image of triangling, and that's churches just do that all over the place, where you as a powerful person, even though you may not perceive yourself that way, get triangled, you know, between two people who are competing for scarce time, attention, space, money, whatever, and they'll try and get you involved, you know, and the thing you have to constantly do is say that, have you talked to so-and-so directly? And if not, I'd be happy to sit in the room with the two of you while you talk, you know, but I'm not going to talk to Sally, for you on your behalf. You are going to have to follow Matthew 18 and you're going to have that conversation. And because I found it was destructive in our patterns, I was watching that kind of gossip and freezing in and out and those feelings. It's taken me quite a while to get it healthy. And it's taken kind of deliberate intentionality to do that. Other than that, I don't know what to say, having not been a man in that setting.
curious about your relationship with the church, evangelical women that they belong to, in relating with more liberal women within your own denomination, and to what kind of relationships have you been able to develop with them? Have you been able to see you or envision yourself as being in any kind of way as a,
That's a very good question. The honest answer to the question is no. The failure of the evangelical church to empower and affirm its women usually means that by the time a woman has settled down into a camp politically, she has had negative or bad experiences with conservatives and evangelicals that emotionally it's one thing if you get them young. It's another thing if you get them after seminary, after bad experiences, after they have decided postmodern or, you know, whatever patterns. And I hold the evangelical conservative part of the church fully responsible for a great deal of that. And it's, to me, a tragedy and a sadness. So a lot of my ministry has been about trying to speak to the conservative side of the church about their failure, and I have had a lot of success at that level of getting openness, you know, to women.
And you would believe that a large number of liberal women today are where they are because the church is not.
I do believe that. I need to be a little broader than that, though. There is a theological establishment which has more radical women in it, and radical women and local church congregations usually don't make it together. But they go into academia, and you know, they're bright, they're influential, and in the universities and in the seminaries and in the graduate programs. And so there is definitely an impact from the academic establishment and some of the more radical persons in those environments who are not accountable to local congregations, you know, in the same way, etc. And one of the tragedies is they may shape young, malleable persons to be more radical because the injustices are there, etc. But then those women are unable to function back in the local church because they haven't learned that the main way people change is through love. They don't change through politics. They don't change through anger. I mean, if you just have to look at Jesus' model of change, and it's a model of sacrifice and love. And the more radical models will say that sacrifice and love, the cross, for instance, is offensive. And the models of servanthood and sacrifice, whether male or female, have been so laid on females that we have to assert ourselves and we cannot, you know, practice sacrifice. It's demeaning. And unfortunately, that renders a younger woman who buys into that with quite a bit of dysfunctionality as she tries to figure out how to both, as one of my female staff members said, how not to be squashed and yet how to be a servant. And women have that burden that, in a way, many men have the same burden, and women don't acknowledge it. They don't realize that many men, you know, are never going to be the senior pastor with the power slot, you know, thinking in those human kinds of terms. And so you can get dysfunctional, you can get angry, disillusioned, or cynical. And that's why I think your spiritual life and a small community I've always had a small community of Christian women, and many of them pastors, you know, that I've been close to. And I think I've had a positive influence on women who were in the middle and were open on things. But I have really been written off by the more radical women as an enemy. And it's been painful, you know, to experience. The very first time I ran into this was at the University of Washington. They were doing a women's week, and I was at a university church. I got asked if I'd come and speak on the campus because I was a professional woman, I guess, in religion, and they wanted something out of the world of religion. And the first thing they did was hand me a sheet of paper, which I was supposed to sign, which was an advocacy of a lesbian agenda and a pro-abortion on demand agenda. And I said, you know, I'm not signing this, and because this does not reflect in my own convictions. And they said, well, then you can't participate in Woman Week. I said, come on, you know, all women are not the same, et cetera. And I ended up participating on the you can't discriminate kind of a basis. But I realized right then and there, you know, the sisterhood idea, women are as diverse as men are. And we are diverse theologically, and the idea that because we're women, we're all going to be on the same page, feel the same things, behave the same ways, have the same leadership styles, that's just as much a fallacy as thinking all men are going to do that. But we have to do everything we can not to demonize and make enemies out of the other. The assumption we have to come off of is we have no enemies. We do not act toward anyone as if they are our enemy. If they choose to act in ways that are that way, then that's between them and God. You know, but we do not. I try very hard not to demonize people who are in a different place. And if you know some of the stories, the personal stories, I know some of those personal stories, and they're horrible. I mean, they're stories of a kind of oppression that when those women started off moderate, and they're not moderate anymore. And it's because of what they've experienced. So, I mean, they are accountable to God for the choices they make. Nobody's a victim, ultimately, I don't believe, that we have to choose a victimization posture. But nonetheless, the church carries a large burden of responsibility. That's why I think every woman and man, that's it, to come back to your thing, has to be an advocate for women. And the advocacy of males really matters. As long as males still control so much of the power structure. But what I find is women aren't interested in the evangelical theological agenda because they perceive the evangelical church as not supportive of them as persons. And so therefore, they just don't get causal the same way that the male evangelical leadership will get causal. And it's a tragedy, and I've been warning about it for 20 years. And it's better in some places and not at all better in other places. And it's a very heavy burden for women to have to carry. And the men need to come alongside and realize it's a heavy burden, and they shouldn't make women lift and carry it alone. They really need to bear one another's burdens, male and female. We're going to have to stop. We're out of time. So thanks. Fun to be with you. If you didn't sign in, you did.